I'm Terry Thornton. I'm curator of education. It's my great pleasure to welcome you to Tuesday evenings at the Modern. I'm so glad to be back. As I think most of you know, this is our first Tuesday evening for the 2013 season, or the 2013 winter-spring season. And whereas the museum celebrated its 10 years in this building in December, this program is celebrating its 10 years this season. So we're off to a great start with artist Gary Simmons. Many of you will recall that Gary was scheduled to be here in the fall, but I'm afraid that Hurricane Sandy had other plans. So Gary's Focus exhibition and his Tuesday evening lecture were both rescheduled. Of course, Focus, Gary Simmons, opened on January 13th, so I have to say I truly appreciate Gary returning tonight for this lecture, because I'm fully aware of just how busy he is as an artist and a teacher, and I know that Sandy took a toll on his studio and life. So again, I really appreciate him getting back on a plane and coming back for us this evening. I hope you have all had the pleasure of spending time with Gary's work in the current Focus exhibition, and I would like to thank the Modern's curator, Andrea Carnes, for bringing it to Fort Worth. Gary has had a productive career, completing his BFA at the School of Visual Arts in New York in 1988, receiving an MFA from the California Institute of Arts in Valencia, California in 1990, and receiving an NEA grant that same year. Gary has received attention early for his very forthright address of race, pedagogy, and culture in his expansive erasure drawings, such as Wall of Eyes, which was commissioned in 1993 by the Whitney Biennial. As it turns out, 1993 was a very interesting year, so much so that the new museum has an exhibition that opens this coming weekend, New York City, 1993, Experimental Jet Set, Trash, and No Star, which of course includes the work of Gary Simmons. Represented by Metro Pictures in New York, where his solo exhibition just closed at, solo exhibition just closed at Metro Pictures in New York. He's also represented by Reagan Projects in LA, where he opens a show in May. See what I mean about being very busy? I cannot believe he's sitting here. Anthony Meyer, Fine Arts in San Francisco, also represents his work, as does Simon Lee Gallery in London. Gary's exhibition record is extensive. He is represented in impressive public and private collections, including the Albright Knox Art Gallery in Buffalo, the Hirshhorn Museum and Sculpture Garden in D.C., the Museum of Contemporary Art, Chicago, MoCA in Los Angeles, the MoMA, the Studio Museum of Harlem, Walker Art Center in Minneapolis, and the Whitney Museum of American Art, to name a few. The work has also reached a broad audience through large public exposure, such as the Dallas Cowboys Stadium, and billboard commissions, such as Undefeated in L.A. in 2009, I Wish It Could Be Morning All Day Long at the recent Art Basel Miami Beach, with another one currently in the works, as I understand it. An impressive monograph, Gary Simmons' Paradise, which is available in the Modern Shop, brings together Gary's photographs, installations, sculptures, drawings, and paintings with 150 color plates. It's a beautiful publication. An in-depth interview, critical essays, and historical texts, and it was just released this past fall. So I encourage you to go by and pick one up if you didn't. Gary was kind enough to sign them. If you happen to have bought one before they were signed today, I'm sure he would be happy to do that tonight after the lecture. I don't think I have to say much more to make it clear that Gary Simmons is an accomplished and significant artist, and we're most fortunate to have him here with us tonight to share his ideas and developments in his work. So if you would, please join me in showing our appreciation with a warm welcome.
That was quite a intro. But first, I'd like to say thank you so much to Terry and Andrea and Michael and everybody in Fort Worth for having me and doing the exhibition. It's great to be in Texas. I sort of have a real love for Texas. I've had a couple girlfriends from Dallas. So I do have a thing for Texas. I thought that I'd give you a little background on me, and then we can look at some of the work, some of the other works that influenced how I came to making work and things like that. So hopefully we'll have some fun. Everybody good? Everybody all right? I was born in New York, and of two immigrant parents from the West Indies. My dad was a pretty well-known cricket player in the West Indies. So sports was a really big influence from a really early age, sort of shaped the way that I thought about a lot of different things, and it comes through in a lot of the work later on. My dad sort of pushed me to become sort of a professional athlete. I really loved making work. The legend goes, my mother, if she was here, would love to tell you that when I was really little, she couldn't stop me from drawing all over the walls. So she likes to tell people that I still do that, but now I get paid for it. So it's a really kind of a nice thing. But, I grew up in New York at a time that was really kind of great. Punk rock and hip hop was, punk was already established, and hip hop was just sort of in its early days, and that really sort of formed punk rock and hip hop and just being in New York, downtown New York at that time, really shaped a lot of us. And I think we hung out with a lot of musicians, a lot of writers, a lot of graffiti people, all different types of people, and we all sort of mixed together. I think the only people we didn't hang out with were the heavy metal people. They weren't really very nice. But there was this exchange, and I think that there was an understanding of culture and cross-culture influences. And one of the earliest pieces, I think I'd like to show you a video to give you an idea of what my thought process was, is right here. Can we show that video?
My plan said I had to get out and break north. Just like Oliver's neck, I had to get off. boys had the pants in check. They couldn't try the fear. We had a force to instigate a prison riot. This is what it takes for peace. So I just took a piece. Black for black, it's high time to cut the leash. Freedom to get out to the ghetto. No sellout. 60 years we got, we ought to put their head out. But I'll give them a chance, cause I'm civilized. As for rest of the world, they can't realize a cell is hell. I'm a rebel, so I rebel. Between bars, got me thinking like an animal. Got a woman, she overcall me a copter. She tried to get away, and I popped her twice, right? Never wanna get nice. I had 60 years, and now it's 5 to go, and I'm serious. Call me delirious, but I'm still a captive. I got a rap, it's time to break. As time grows intense, I got my steel in my right hand. Now I'm looking for the fence.
I think I showed you that because at the time in the 80s, hip-hop and punk rock was big. And I think that what that was there was a strong voice of youth, myself included. And I think that kids were really politically aware and wanted to create a voice of their own. And at the same time, I was going to visual arts and later Cal Arts. And the work that I was really looking at the time was the picture generation. These are the artists, really, that kind of shaped the way for me to process what I was looking at and dealing with in my sort of regular life, and then my studio life. What I was looking at, being trained to look at, was really the kind of early 80s picture generation. And the way that, we were lectured to in school, the sort of developing a critical voice was at a premium. And critical theory was the way, which shaped the way that you thought through ideas. So artists like Cindy Sherman, David Solly, Basquiat, who for me was kind of a hybrid in an odd way. I thought that he was being processed in the art world differently than how he was making his work in the studio. And so he was a very interesting kind of character, the way he was kind of co-opted in what his work was and what it was being projected as. But it was also a kind of entryway, a kind of an artist that you would look at and say, hey, I could do that. This is work that responds to me. This is work that talks not only to music and youth, but also had this art historical sort of placement as well. Kruger was huge for me because Kruger was one of the first few artists that I physically could see. I'd studied other artists prior, obviously, but the way that she treated the room and politicized the institution of the gallery and placed you in the work as an installation had a strong, really strong effect. I think Holzer had another real effect on, and I love that Holzer piece that's in the garden out there. Hans Hacke. So a lot of these folks we were reading. It was interesting because we were just talking about publications and artists writing and things like that. And I think that publications like Parquet, October, all of those kinds of publications were really sort of huge. And it was intertwined with not only the way to make art, but also the way that you think about art. There was a sort of criticality that was necessary to the time, and that art was reflective of what was going on in the outside world. Group Material had a huge effect. General Idea. Felix Gonzalez Torres holds a very special place for me, both as a person and as an artist. I really enjoyed the way that he was able to infuse a kind of personal voice into highly conceptualized political work. And I just thought that his work, when I first started to show, I can remember being at White Columns in the gallery, and I was talking to Bill Arning at the time, and I looked at this piece, and it just hit me, and I was just, who is this guy? And he said, oh, this is somebody you should know, and he introduced me to Felix, and we'd been friends pretty much to the end of his life. For me, I think Felix is probably one of the greatest artists of my generation. He spoke to everything from the politics of AIDS and what it meant to be an artist creating work in a kind of conceptual arena and also finding his personal voice. Katie Nolan was big as a sort of a person that really extended the understanding of installation for me. It was really kind of groundbreaking work. I've always been a huge fan of hers. This is the first piece that I made in 1989 called Disinformation Chalkboard. At the time, I was working in a studio in an old vocational school, and the section of studio that was mine held all these chalkboards. And when I was in school, I was studying with Kossuth, Jackie Windsor, Jack Whitten, artists like that, and I was studying it at Visual Arts. And one of the things that Visual Arts really impressed on me was, well, there were the artists, the working artists that you worked with and for, and they, the sort of that conceptual minimalist sort of aesthetic was something that really left an impression on me. So when I was working in the studio, I was trying to work through all of these ideas about minimalism and conceptualism, and one of the frustrating things for me was that there was no voice. There was no way that I could access this work. I was drawn to it visually, but I couldn't find my voice in that. I always enjoyed Joel Shapiro's work, a number of artists that dealt with aesthetics in a certain kind of way that also had a relationship to the architecture and the room and the institution that it was in. But for me, I really wanted to use that, but find my voice. And searching for that, to make a piece in the studio, I would have to move these chalkboards from wall to wall to wall to get out of the way. So if I was working over there, I'd have to move them all over here. And all the while, I'm sitting there saying, what material can I possibly work on that could really speak to me and talk to me about education and learning and all this stuff? And I'm busy moving this shit up back and forth. And then suddenly, it just sort of dawned on me, like, Jesus Christ is all around me. So I started to cut up these chalkboards. And that's where the Disinformation Chalkboard series started. I was really interested in an object that maintained the notion of learning, of teaching, had a kind of historical relationship to artists in the past, like Boyce, Twombly, people like that. And it was sort of the perfect material for me to work on that melded all these things together. The paragraph was based on sort of governmental letters and how I was really interested in how government letters were sort of censored when they were passed around. And I really liked the word form became these kind of bars, and there was information there, but you couldn't access it. So I was really interested in how that extended to the education form, how children are taught. And those are the things that I was really questioning at the time. Private Schoolroom is of the same series. I was really interested in the sort of the grid. So I took the notion of the lectern, right, like this, and created these sort of children-sized lecterns that the microphones were clipped so that the voices were kind of removed. And I was really interested in that kind of back-and-forth dialogue between the politics that I was referencing, but also the minimalism from the past. So the grid plays a really strong place in a lot of the work that I do. This is the Big Dunce. I've always loved this piece. I was thinking of the idea of punishment and how a bad kid would be, the idea that the bad kid would be forced to sit in the corner and put this hat on their head.
So I made this giant felt dunce hat, and I thought that that was a really interesting kind of poke in the ribs to the minimalists and Robert Morris and people like that. Newsflag is around the same time. There's no date up there. I think it's around 89, 90, where the work was really, primarily when I first started making work, I was making objects. And I was really interested in how the relationship between a viewer and an object, very different than, say, like a drawing or a painting. I thought that that sort of sits on the wall, and an object was more confrontational. An object is something that has a sort of, you're familiar with that object in some way. And so there's always a kind of play between what you know and what you question and things in like that. So there's this back and forth that goes on. 6X is a piece that in some ways sort of put me on the map. It's a piece that when I was making, there's a funny story to making this piece. I was making it in L.A., and I had this studio downtown, and I'm busy sewing these little suits together, and the FedEx guy comes to the door, and and he was African-American, and so he walks in, and he just freaked out. He says, "What is going on here? You're making suits for the Klan, and you're black, and you're thick. What? You know?" He just flipped his wig completely back. And I said, "Well, just relax a second." He was running out the door, and I said, "Just relax, and we'll talk about what this is about." And I was started to tell him about the idea of how racism, you know, my ideas for the piece was that racism is a taught thing and a learned thing, and that you teach a child to hate and things like that, and that it starts at an early age. And you know, he sort of got into it, and he sat down, and we had a coffee and things, and I think he was late for where he was going. But we had a really interesting kind of exchange, and that's kind of when I knew that the piece was really charged, because I knew that I was dealing with imagery that was pretty, it was going to light some fires, but I didn't have the immediacy of somebody that wasn't art, that wasn't art-centric, so to speak. And it was a very interesting conversation about the ideas of race and racism and things like that. And so this piece has been attacked a number of times, actually. Whenever it gets installed, people seem to have a real incredible response to it. The hats have been stolen two or three times, so there are like children-sized Klan hats floating around somewhere. It's a pretty big statement, I guess you could say. The eraser chair, for me, I think that the work really started to change here, because I was really interested in taking the object of the schoolroom chair, and I had all these chalkboard erasers around, and I started to cover the chair with all the chalkboard erasers. And you can't really see it in the slide because it's not a very good image, but there is this kind of absence of a presence in the seating. And, you know, I kind of sanded it down so that it appeared as if a student had just got up from the object. And I think that that's where the ghosting and tracing really started. I think that I was really interested in that kind of, that's the sense of how a space can be haunted after one leaves a room. And eraser chair was the piece that changed that. Poliwana is probably the other piece that I would say was the cornerstone, in that I was doing an exhibition early, when is that, 91, in Los Angeles, and the gallery, originally there were chalkboards that was fabricated for the piece, but the gallery, for one reason or the other, didn't want to ship the piece. And it was really important to me for the exhibition to have that. So I decided to paint directly on the wall with the chalkboard paint. And how the piece works is there's this, the bird is live. So I sort of rented the bird from a Hollywood animal rental something. And so she arrived at the gallery, and I didn't really, you know, I don't own parrots or anything. And it was funny because she would yell into the, she would squawk into the microphone and yell, "Fuck you." "And I love you." So I thought that was just brilliant. And it sort of added to the piece, something that you never know is going to happen when an artist is doing a piece. But it was really great because everybody would come in, and I was immediately thinking of Vito Acconci's piece where he was yelling into the microphone at people as they entered. The bird was doing the same thing where people would come into the gallery and they would immediately hear this, you know, squawking parrot yelling, "Fuck you, fuck you." And it was really kind of an interesting exchange between the piece and the viewer. But one of the byproducts of this piece for me was that I didn't anticipate was that when I painted the black on the wall and the bird, the flight, the bird would flap her wings while she was on the lectern, and there was this really beautiful cinematic trace that would happen where the bird would sort of move like this, and you'd just see this trail of the wings and feathers. And I looked at that, and I was like, wow, I got to get that in my work. There's something there, something visceral, something ghost-like, that kind of trace of movement. So I got back to New York immediately and started working, trying to get that. And I realized that when I drew on this chalkboard surface, if I tried to erase it, that you couldn't totally erase the image. And that, for me, was really engaging because I thought, in this case, I was working with the crows from Dumbo, but I was really interested in the idea, no matter how hard you worked, there was always this trace of this image that remained. And so I started to play with different things, and I was working separately from the project on a film with a friend, and we were really interested in a film about education, kind of documentary thing. It didn't really work out. But in the research of the film, I started to look at different sort of educational films, and I started to think about Dumbo, and would talk to people of different ages, different races, different, you know, and it started to break down, the memory of that film started to break down along race lines, and certain people would remember the crows from Dumbo, and others wouldn't, only remembering the elephant with the big ears and all of that. And I really thought that was a really interesting moment because the way, as anybody, I'm sure everybody's seen Dumbo, it's about him overcoming this, you know, these big ears and people are making fun of him and this and that. And but the crows teach him that he can use his ears to fly. So I thought that was very interesting that these step and fetch it crows were the ones that actually taught him to overcome this thing that people were making fun of him, and yet it broke down along racial lines. So that's where the erasure drawing started, was with the looking at the crows from Dumbo. I then went back to the same gallery and was invited to do a show again, and I did this piece, which is really untitled. That's a miss. I did that too. I wrote that. That's horrible. But it's called Untitled, and this is one of the crows from a scene from Dumbo. So it's the first erasure drawing. I'm a little bit out of order here. I don't know why I did that. But as I was moving through different cartoons, I was looking at a lot of the race cartoons from the early 30s and 40s, Tex Avery, different propaganda films that were looking at the war, and how cartoons would sort of set up these propaganda films at the beginning of each film session. So I would use those films and start to mine those sort of images and things. And as I moved through them, like any artist, you start to develop your own language. And through the use of these images, I started to pull out
the sort of signifiers of what marked those either crows or mice or whatever it was as racializing them. So through that, I started to create my kind of own visual catalog in a way and started to put things together. And for me, I like to describe myself as a kind of visual DJ, somebody that takes an image from here and takes an image from there and mixes it and crossfades it, and then it gives you a new image. And I think most artists do the same thing. I think it's the way that you process images and show somebody something that they already know in a different way. So for me, I started to really take the images from Dumbo, from Little Old Bosco in this case, and start to mix them together with other very charged images. Wall of Eyes was done at the Whitney, as was mentioned. And at this piece, the importance of this was that this was a collection of all the eyes of all the characters that I'd done up until that point. And for me, it was the point where I can sort of start to fragment my own work. And that kind of fragmentation sort of still holds today in how I approach making things, and because I think that it reflects the way that we think about and construct our memory. That we look at things in or look back on things sort of in flashes. And a memory is never really fixed the further we move away from it. So there's a kind of blurring that occurs when you try to recall something. Maybe it's the first time you're in love with somebody. Maybe it's the first bad experience that you had. But you shift that in your mind. And I always loved to connect that to the art, to the drawings themselves. That when I do these drawings, you have to kind of experience them in person. And as you take away what you've gotten from the image, that starts to degrade as well in your memory. So there's a doubling of that kind of erasure that goes on. There's the literal erasure that I do, and then there's the erasure that goes on with the viewer after the fact. The ballroom was the first time that I was invited to do an entire sort of, I don't know how you describe the Lannan Foundation. It was a really beautiful foundation in Los Angeles, and they had probably one of the most beautiful rooms I've ever installed in. Excuse me. I like to think that whenever I come to do a lot of these drawings, that the room and the history of the place sort of talks to me. So when I immediately walked into the Lannan Foundation, the first thing that I thought about was two lovers like dancing in a ballroom fashion in this room. It was a stunning floor, really high ceilings. And I started to think about that notion of lovers and dancing and space and how we move through that. And that kind of dictated the way that I started to construct all the images around the room so that I can actually place, like I was talking about with the Kruger, that I could sort of place the viewer in a kind of environment that I constructed. So in this case, I started to take some of the backgrounds instead of the figures that marked or signified anything in the cartoon. I started to take the backgrounds of the environments that those figures occupied, and then the viewer would then get thrown into this life size or scale room drawing. So this drawing is probably about 70 feet from there to there. Boom is another piece that has gotten a lot of attention over time. Really, I was interested in the kind of inherent violence that occurs in cartoons, that we expose children to this kind of violence, and it's all under the umbrella of kind of comedy. And I like the idea of that kind of violence comedy thing that was going on. And so I took the explosion of a fight or some kind of chaos that was going on. You'll see images like this in a lot of cartoons where you see like the little fists flying out and stars and things. So I removed all the little fists and all of that and was really interested in this idea of an image that's frozen, that comes from a cinematic source, that's frozen and it sort of implies both explosion and implosion at the same time. And that for me was really, that kind of flipping back and forth on that scale was really significant. I also like that the way that when I do the drawings, it sort of incorporates the institution that it's drawn on. So it's sort of a commentary on the place that it sits. So this was I believe this installation shot was in Manhattan, in Soho, when Metro was in Soho. This is the Ghoster. The Ghoster, a lot of times, is described, sometimes written, that it's Coney Island Cyclone. It's not exclusively Coney Island Cyclone. Actually, what I did was I sort of took three or four or five different roller coasters and kind of morphed them together. So I like the idea that there's pieces of it that people can access in their own sort of experience, that they feel like they've been there before, they feel like they can locate it, but in fact, there's different markers that'll like take them right out of that moment of location. So I think that there's something really interesting about the moment when you feel like, wow, I've seen this before, but not really, you know. And so I think that the Ghoster kind of works like that. It also is a kind of reference to childhood. I go back to childhood a lot because I think that we have a way of nostalgically looking at our childhood, whether good or bad. I think we, you know, you'll talk to someone and say, oh, you know, I had this horrible childhood, or I had this really wonderful childhood. You idealize it one way or the other, but it's never really true to the actual experience, and that is shifting, and that is actually fragments from different places. I have this photograph that my grandmother, I think my grandmother took it. It's me and my sister, and I'm in one of those little pedal cars, you know, and it's really, it looks kind of like an Instagram now, actually. It's kind of funny. But I've heard my grandmother tell me the story about what goes on in that photograph so many times that storytelling has become my memory. I don't actually have a true memory of what I was doing in there, but she's told me that so many times that's become that. And I look back at that and I think that's a really interesting kind of moment where your memory is kind of constructed for you through the use of storytelling. And so that's where I think a lot of the erasure drawings come from. Soundgarden, I started to go back to I'm a sort of schizophrenic in a certain studio kind of way. I work on the drawings, I work on paintings, I work on objects at the same time. But I was really interested in Soundgarden. What you have here is a section of floor, which I believe it's 9x9. It replicates the Boston Garden, which is where the Boston Celtics play. And on the speakers above was a instruction of ballroom dancing. And as the tape sort of loops, there's bits and pieces that are erased from the loop. So by the time it runs its course, I think it's 35 minutes or something, it goes from the full lesson all the way down to, you know, turn left, right. So you're losing bits and pieces, and if you actually were there to stay the whole loop, you'd understand it, that there is this instruction that's being erased as you're watching it. And I love the idea of athletes and sports pop up in my work a lot. And there's a sort of beauty to the way that athletes move around in their field of choice, whether it's a football field, a basketball floor, a wrestling mat, whatever it is. I've always loved the way that it's almost like a dance when it's done at that high level. The lineup. This actually, if you're following the dates, it sort of bounces around. So the lineup was a piece where I took, at the time in the early 90s, in New York, I think LA as well, it was very popular to try to get Air Jordans, the very, you know, whatever the most popular, they still do it now, the most popular basketball shoe that's on the street. And at the time, kids were actually shooting each other for their shoes. And in a twist, in a really twisted way, it was more and I don't want to say acceptable, but it was more desired to actually seek out or hunt somebody down to find the shoes that you wanted in your size. So it was almost like this stalker kind of mentality, and jump that guy for his shoes. And I thought that was really twisted. And how, for me, it was how much of that is played into, is how much is the sneaker company involved in constructing that kind of violence. So, that's where some of the ideas of the piece came from. One of the critics that wrote about this piece really talked about it as, and there's giant shoes are outsized and all of this stuff, and he's going on about how it's not normal to have these size shoes. So I met the guy at an opening a few months later, and I said, so I saw your piece. And he said, yeah, really felt the shoes were really big. And I said, yeah, actually, those are my shoes. So, and he sort of felt like an idiot. So that was kind of nice. Step in the Arena is another piece that kind of couples both the sports and this. There's a drawing here on the... I like this little pointer thing. There's a drawing here, an instruction of two people ballroom dancing in the ring. And I always loved the idea of boxers dancing around the ring. Ali was probably the most famous at it, but the way that they would dance and move around the ring. Boxing pops up, as you can see, from 94, and even in the piece that's in the galleries now, plays a big part in a lot of the work that I do, because I think that boxing kind of... it is highly politicized, and it sort of transcends the sport. It goes outside of just it being a sport, and at certain times it became sort of moments of highly charged political moments. Ali just choosing not to go to the army comes to mind, or a figure like Jack Johnson from the past was highly politicized. So I think that boxing doesn't quite have the same sort of view now or significance now, because I think that sports there's a really wide reach and just different types of sports, from X Games and skateboarding to basketball, football, any of the sort of traditional professional sports. I think that it's really the playing field, so to speak, has really broadened. So I don't think boxing quite has that, but I do think that I am interested in the sort of nostalgia of boxing and the way that we look back at that. And often if you talk to people that are interested in boxing, they always go to the past. They rarely go to the present. And I find that really interesting, that somebody has to choose to go to the past, and then they do this whole fragmentation thing. And so there's a mirroring of how people talk about it and how it sort of sits within the terms of my work. The Forest for the Trees was, I think, 10 chalkboards. Kind of schoolroom chalkboards. They're double-sided. Images are on both sides. And I was really interested in how I would sort of force the viewer to kind of move through the images physically and then turn around and come back. So your recollection of the image that you passed, or if you were coming from the other way, is also fragmented. So that sense of passing through, or forcing the body to move through a space with images passing you by, the piece came to me. I used to have to take the train, Metro North. I was teaching in Connecticut, and I would take this train, and these stations would just go by, and the way that they would go by would kind of reflected sort of the parrot in the earlier piece, and they were all sort of the same town, in a sense. You know, they all had those same building markers that you'd pass by, and I really liked the way that you passed through space and how it was marked in that way. And so that's kind of what the influences for the Forest of the Trees were. Later on, I don't have a date on this one, I think it's, I want to say 98, something like that, I did The Big Still. And I was really interested in taking some of the drawings that I was doing. I should kind of backtrack a little bit. The drawings usually start, whether they used to start in a bar. I don't drink anymore, so.
But they, you know, they start on like a bar napkin, a coffee napkin, something like that. An idea will hit me, and I'll sort of scrawl it down and put it in my pocket and get it back home, scan it, and put it in the computer, and sort of keep it that way. And what I'll do is I'll get an idea, and then I sort of research it and get as much images as I can. And it comes to me, and I sort of edit it down from there. So I was really interested in the idea of drunkenness, and I mean real serious drunkenness, not like sipping wine after dinner or something. I mean, like, you see people that get inebriated to the point where they can't walk, they can't function, and I was really, it's sort of a sad thing to watch somebody just get that far outside of their experience that they need to drink themselves into oblivion. And I thought, that's really interesting that you want to be anywhere else but here. And so the ideas of the show started to think, I was thinking about this notion of inebriation. And I started to collect images of stills from all over. And some of them were confiscated images of confiscated stills from the past and things. And I always liked the idea that a still is something that you never really see. You kind of think that you know what it looks like, but you don't, because they're all different. And they're always done like in your bathtub or in the backyard or out in the woods or something. Nobody ever sees them. You get the moonshine and it's, you know, it's crazy. But so I took this image from a police photograph and started doing drawings. And I met a sort of company that could actually translate my drawings into what is now, I guess, the CAD program and make it a 3D. So they took an erased drawing and then made a three-dimensional object out of it. So what you're looking at is a three-dimensional eraser drawing, so to speak. The stills are always painted to match the gallery walls, so they kind of disappear, kind of ghost-like. And I sort of like the way that there's that kind of exchange between the object and the room. Just the way that I talk is another piece that I did where I invited a DJ friend, DJ Rob Swift from The Executioners. I was always a big fan of their work. And I approached Rob and I said, listen, I got this idea for a piece. Would you be interested in doing the sound part? And so I had my wife actually read Saussure's Construction of Language into a microphone in a very paced sort of way. And then I gave that recording to Rob Swift and he sort of cut it back and forth. So he was literally taking Saussure's semiotic text about semiotics and cutting it up back and forth on this turntable thing. So that's the sound that is recorded that comes out of the old school boombox. In the blink of an eye, I was invited to do an exhibition at the Bowen Foundation in New York, and it's an incredible room that was, it was done by an architectural firm called Low Tech. And the whole show was based on the year 1964. So I was really interested in the glass house, Hitchcock's Marnie, which came out in 64. 64 is also the year that I was born. That's sort of a side thing. Nobody, it's not part of the work, but that's one of the significant moments. But I really liked Hitchcock's film Marnie because it was sort of reviewed in an odd sort of way. And there's a moment, I don't know if everybody's seen Marnie, but there's this woman, and to kind of compress it, she's kind of this kleptomaniac. Whenever she sees the color red, she sort of loses her presence for the moment. She gets really dizzy and like that. And so I really liked the idea of taking this color red, this like saturated red, and breaking down the three installations into the kind of RGB construction. So there's a blue one, a green one, a red one. And then the red one is the chandeliers from Marnie. What's interesting about this was an enclosed room. And I had two or three people actually sort of pass out in this piece because of the movement of the work, and I thought that was just great. Of course, the people that owned the foundation weren't too thrilled about that. But so we had to put a little disclaimer in there and all that. This is the an image. Anybody that's traveled back and forth to New York knows, can recognize. It's from the World's Fair, and it's in a sort of, it's all falling apart now, but it's such a marker in New York, both, I think, historically and as an icon in the city, that I've passed it a million times and I've always wanted to play with that, and I really like the idea of reflecting the idea of mirroring an image where it feels like you're both passing through and you're arriving and leaving at the same time. House Burn is a piece that film really comes up a lot in my work. I would probably say if I had to put my finger on two things, it would probably be sports and film. And I think film probably plays a bigger role for me. And in this image, this is the last scene from a film called The Island of Dr. Moreau, where, to compress that, there's a psycho doctor who's trying to make this perfect... what am I trying to say? He's trying to create a new human form by kind of morphing animals and humans together. It all goes crazy and goes wrong, and it's sort of an interesting kind of reflection of society. I would say that science fiction it pops up a lot in my work, whether it's Planet of the Apes or Island of Dr. Moreau. I pick and choose. Those kinds of films, because there's a way that at the time they sort of reflected society. And whether it's the riots of the 60s in Planet of the Apes, or it's in the 70s with Island of Dr. Moreau. Marked Increase was from an installation that was based on Planet of the Apes. So I started to do these draw. I did wall drawing installation that was taken, well, it mirrored the kind of signage that's around Los Angeles, old kind of nostalgic signage that's around the buildings, and took some of the text and vocal from the movie and started mixing those back and forth. And this is Hollywood. That's the last image for today. I think I'd open up to questions if you guys are into it. Thank you.
Would the bird fly off?
No, she stayed on the there was a little rail. We for the whole day, actually. That was the beauty of getting a Hollywood bird, was that she was trained to do that. But, you know, I would take her off at the, you know, once or twice a day, and she'd go and eat her food and do the thing. There was water and food and stuff up at the lectern, so. She made a mess all over the place. It was crazy.
Going back to your ballroom situation, you said you love the floor, you love the room. So is the way that all comes about, they commission you, you come and look at the space, and then decide what you want to do?
Yes. Yeah. It's not unlike here, you know, where Andrea will invite me to do a show, and then I'll come and, well, in this case, we didn't do a site visit, but often I'll do a site visit and kind of, you know, sit with the room or the place and try to get a sense of what, if I don't know it, try to get a sense of that. I really am affected by the architecture a lot. Like, this is a beautiful room. What I would do in here, I don't know. But it's, you know, it's one of those things where I have to sit in a room for a while, and then it would sort of tell me what to do in that way.
You know, you talked about finding the critical voice, and you shared a number of influences, like race and violence, sports and films. which have shaped your work. Does your critical voice change as the influence evolve and change, or is the critical voice, or is your critical voice maintained through a reliance on the influences of the past?
That's a great question. That's almost a two-part question, because I think that I think it does change. I think any artist changes. I think there's a kind of foundation that you go to. I had an interesting talk once with kind of a mentor, godfather figure, Baldessari, and I was watching John install a show. He was getting ready for a show, and I said, John, you know, that looks a lot like this piece from the past. And he was like, you know, I'm really happy that I'm at this point in my life where I can actually start to reference older work. And there's a kind of cyclical thing that goes on. And I thought, wow, that's amazing. I only can hope to get to that stage, that you can start to have that play with your own voice, with the marks that you've made. So I think that it shifts, but I think that it also, there's also a coming back around. I kind of feel like I'm sort of starting to do that now, where I'm starting to... you know, when you start to make work as a young artist, you don't know if you're ever going to get an opportunity again. So when you're young, you want to make these big, brash marks and scream. And as you're given more opportunities, you start to realize that the screaming part isn't quite as effective as if you sort of poke really hard, repeatedly. You know, so and I think that how you develop that is you start to get comfortable with making your work and putting it out there, and then you start to realize that one sort of builds off of the other, and it's not kind of what I call artist Frogger, where you get a great idea and then you hop off onto another great idea. You know, it's kind of, you sort of develop and morph the way that your work, and then it starts to talk back to itself. And I think that, so I think that it changes as you mature, and but the core is probably still there.
So like, you talk a lot about nostalgia and stuff, and there's a lot of things that, you know, you use to reference within your work, but like, I'm just curious, is there anything like in your personal life that you used to reference in your work? Like, is there anything that, any personal experiences that you've taken and you're like, this is, I'm going to use this experience and I'm going to make a piece to show, be like, represent that experience and to show what it is?
No, I think I understand. No. It's, you know why? Because I don't, it's the same reason why I don't use the figure. I'll reference the figure, but you'll never see a figure. You'll never see, because I think that kind of freezes it into one isolated experience. If it was just my experience, then I think that it would be very easy to dismiss it as just like, oh, well, that's Gary's experience. So I try to remove that and step back. And I think that's where I sort of revere somebody like a Felix, you know, that had that ability to kind of step back away and pull himself out, even though it's about, if you really dig into Felix's work, that's about Felix and Ross and the love that they shared. But when you look at it as a viewer cold, it's a very different construction. And he had that ability to swing back and forth between those two, like maintain his own personal experience, but blow it out into something that we can all access. And I think that it's really important for an artist to maintain those kinds of access avenues into a work. That it's not just a kind of myopic experience, and then because then you're just looking at it from the outside. You know, it's almost like a witness to something as opposed to being a part of something. So I personally like to have those avenues open, that what I provide is something that you can access in your own terms, and then you can access it in another set of terms and things like that. There's a common, but comes from different directions.
This is a detailed question, and it goes back to that white boxing ring with the black dance steps on them. On the ropes, there are some black objects. What are those?
They're tap shoes, actually. And the shoes, I've used the shoes a number of times. I think that they're a really interesting kind of marker of neighborhoods. I think that you'll see them in Fort Worth, Dallas, L.A., San Francisco, Paris. They, in different neighborhoods, you'll see kids will throw them over the wires. And they translate into different things in different areas. Sometimes they're gang territory. Sometimes it's a drug spot. Sometimes it's just kids just playing, throwing other kids' shoes up there. And I think that the idea that it has that kind of multiple read for me is really sort of interesting, because I think it leaves... there's an absence of the person that was the person that wore the shoes, and then there's what we import into the meaning of that. So there's a kind of mystery to, you know, what those shoes actually mean.
And what about, not to be too overt, but what about the black dance steps, the black shoes, and a white ring?
Well, the white ring, for me, boxing is such a bloody sport. I mean, it's just violent. And, when it's... That amount of whiteness around there would be, it would leave such a trace of the presence of those boxers that, usually a boxing ring is not as pristinely white as that. And so I think that for me, that the color, I'm glad that you asked that, because I think that the color in that case, it's funny, actually, because early on I never used to use color. I was adamant against using any color at all. It was just black and white. That's it. Because for me, color allowed a viewer to move elsewhere, and I really wanted it to be central to the ideas of what the work was about. And in that piece, I thought that the color white was so significant as this kind of this place of innocence, this place that's unmarked, and that the notion of two boxers fighting in there, leaving, blood and spit and everything else in there would be just, you build the image in your head. I always think about this great film by Stan Brakhage, where he did an autopsy. And it's a really graphic film. I saw it in film school. And what he did was he turned the sound off in this autopsy. And it's really graphically, it's intense. People walk out, they get sick, the whole bit. And the thing is that without the sound, it's even more effective, because the sound of what the bone cutting would be in your head is beyond what the actual is. And that Brakhage film has always stayed in my memory.
Talk just a little bit about our conversation before, when we were talking about Disney Studios and how important that was to you, and how this writing came out. Just that conversation again.
We were talking earlier about the importance of artists visiting other artists' studios, and the kind of dialogue and conversations that go on within that fraternity. And I think sometimes, as artists, we get so caught up in all the other stuff that goes into the art world that we forget a little bit about that fraternity, that moment where two artists get together and hash out and talk about ideas. You don't have to agree, but it's really an interesting sort of moment where, and even more interesting, actually, if they come from two different directions. And I think that kind of circuitry happens in art school. I think often, myself included, art students tend to take that for granted, that if you're in a group of 20 in your class and you're moving through and you're getting really focused and competitive or whatever you're doing. But the idea of critique, the idea of exchange of ideas and pushing each other to make better work through that is so important, and we forget about that from time to time. And I think that there's a lot of really interesting publications over the course of time where artists have either done interviews or magazines or zines, or I always loved in the 70s and 80s the punk rock zines, because I thought those were just brilliant. And in a way, I guess blogs are a little bit like that. But for us in New York, we really looked at Austin
L.A., San Francisco. We couldn't go there. So to know what was going on in Austin, we would have to look at a zine. So a bunch of guys would be printing up this thing on a Xerox thing, and you'd be like, wow, the Cows, who the hell are they? You know, and then you'd sort of get that, and you'd go down to the record store, and somebody would play that band, and you'd hear, oh, wow, there's a Circle Jerks. They're amazing. And that was, for us, that was how we understood sort of San Francisco. Or, Black Flag in L.A. And I think that it's really interesting how that's been removed a little bit, and the blog has kind of replaced it. But the problem with blogging is that it's isolated to one person's experience, and it doesn't have that kind of collective zine mentality where it's kind of a grouping of L.A. punks, New York punks, D.C., that kind of thing. And you really sort of accessed almost a culture that way. And I think that artists, it's a similar sort of thing. You know, the internet has really changed. We were talking, Andrea and I were talking about all the biennials. And, Venice and Documenta, the importance of those were like up here, because to see an artist from New Zealand or, I don't know, Nigeria or something, you'd have to go to Venice. You'd have to fly there and experience their work. But now I could get on this computer, click, 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 and I can see everything that's going on. São Paulo, that's great. You know, where I can go on Twitter and I can immediately get all this information. But I'm not seeing the work in the same way that if I got on a plane, flew to Venice, rented a shitty hotel, ate bad food, went to the pavilion and saw the installation. That is actually seeing the work. And I think that we're moving away from that, and I'm kind of nostalgic for that. And I think that they've written these pieces that artists are writing, that like you guys are working on, is holding on to that. And that's really important, because when I was in school, we used to look at October Magazine, Parquet, things like that. Those were our Bibles, man. Like, that's how we sort of read Craig Owens and Benjamin Buchloh and all these guys, and it kind of geared the way that you thought.
I'm curious about one thing. Have you been asked or commissioned to design sets and costumes for a film or for a stage work or even?
I would love that. I haven't. A dream would be to do an opera stage set. I would love to do an opera stage set with. I don't know if I necessarily would do the costuming, but I would definitely love to do the sets, because somebody that's really influenced a lot of the work that I do is Pina Bausch, and I think Pina Bausch is that troupe is just brilliant, and the way that it's almost like physically constructing a painting. That pieces of physical bodies are moving through space, and other parts of installations are going on. And she had this way, of course, of sort of building a picture frame for you. And so Pina Bausch was amazing. I think Streb is pretty interesting too. So dance, I'm very affected by dance and that. So I would love to do a set. It would be awesome.
There's an element of graffiti in your work, the size and the scale. Have you ever done anything in the...
Yeah, I never talk about it. Yeah, I did.
In the past tense, you wouldn't do
that? Yeah.
That.
When I was younger, we tagged. And that's graffiti was huge in 70s and 80s.
I would expect to see more color in your work, but I understand you use chalk.
Yeah. I think that there was a moment where I had a lot of graffiti friends, and the early, when graffiti first started becoming popular, it broke into two camps. There were the traditionalist, hardcore street guy that was just like, it's just for the street. You just do it on trains. That's what you do. And then there was the other guys who were like, no, we're going to do this in galleries. And the guys, they clashed, because it was sort of like, you guys are perverting the whole thing and blah, blah, blah. So I had a lot of friends that went into the gallery thing. I knew, for some reason, I kind of got lucky. I just knew that wasn't going to work out. For me, it wasn't the way that I wanted to go. And I think it has elements of it. I think that the speed, when I do the erasure drawings, there's still a kind of relationship to that. There's an immediacy to it. They shift and change. The piece that's in the gallery now, I mean, we sort of, you know, changed and shifted that on the fly a little bit. So the space kind of dictates that, and that sort of has a relationship back to graffiti in a way.
Another quick question. Are you working from a drawing, a photograph, or is it all from your mind to the
No. It's a big building process. There's a lot of... it starts with the little bar napkin. I then do a lot of drawings. Then I go to the computer. I'll, you know, kind of clean up the lines, stuff like that. And then it kind of it gets projected to keep it in scale. And then it kind of goes back to the hand. So I use the projector to keep it in scale, but then it's all freehand from there. And then I build into it as well. And the erasure is really kind of mood-driven. You know, if I'm tired, just got off a plane, the drawing's going to drag. If I'm really excited, you know, I got a lot of Red Bull in me, you know, it's going to be.
So what was the reason for the color change in your chalkboard?
You mean the red and the green and that?
Yeah, before the red, blue, and green piece, because I remember the reason for that, but you said you mainly did black and white, and then it looks like there was a sudden pop of color in the chalkboard pigment.
I did green, but that's probably the only chalkboards that I did other than the black. And I think that's because it just had that institutional green, you know, like in university, kind of like that. But color didn't really change until it was really difficult. Color and painting was really a battle for me. Because I think that I have this tendency to kind of... Film is like that. Everywhere I go, everybody says, man, have you ever made a film? You love film so much. And it's like, no, man, I revere film so much. And people work for years and years and years to be filmmakers. You don't just pick up a, you know, video cam and make a film. It always ends up looking like shit. I mean, really. You know, the only person who's actually pulled it off is Julian Schnabel. I think Schnabel's Before Nightfall is stunningly beautiful. I saw it the other day again. But artists, it's sort of, you know, the thing that's cool about making art is that it's the one little area left that forces us to slow down. Like, for 7 to 28 seconds, you have to stand in front of a painting. The rest of our lives is on a computer, on Twitter, on Facebook, on like moving through in your car, billboards flying by. Everything is like about like this. Television, we sit there with the clicker, like click, 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 click. You know, you can't even wait for commercials. I do it. You know, the Knicks are on. I'm like, Jesus Christ, something else has to be on. And, you know, but when you go to a gallery, I'm forced to slow down. You know, I'm looking at a Franz Vest piece, and I have to be with it and spend time with it. And we can't move away from that. So I really love the idea that we actually make objects and take bits and pieces from other places and put them back together and you know, let's think about this for a little while. Thank you.